Hi, my name is Erin Williamson. I'm 40 years old, and today is Monday, March 15th, 2021. I am recording from my home in Woodbridge, Connecticut, and I am here today with my colleagues, Chris Berdini and Yvette Young.
Hi, my name is Yvette Young. I am 44 years old. Today's date is Monday, March 15th, 2021. I'm recording from Hartford, Connecticut, where I work, with my friends and colleagues, Christopher and Erin.
Hi, my name is Christopher Bitterini. I am 33 years old. Today's date is Monday, March 15th, 2021. I'm recording from my home in Plainville, Connecticut, with Yvette Young and Erin Williamson, who are my colleagues.
Hi. All right. So I'm just trying to remember. Can you guys remember when we first met each other? Like the first time we met?
I think for me, my recollection, because it's been probably about 6 years now, was that our first encounter was at one of the human anti-trafficking response teams, where we all sort of had seats at the table. I was a new HART coordinator. You guys, I think, had been affiliated for a while. But that's the first time I saw you guys and probably had any kind of conversation with you.
Yeah. Do you remember that, Chris?
Yeah, I think it must have been, I was a trainer. That's how I started out, doing some of the human anti-trafficking response team trainings. And I believe I met you at one of those.
Yeah, I think I was new to Connecticut. So I came from Washington, D.C., having done human trafficking work in D.C., and then came to Connecticut and was learning the lay of the land that you all have here. Now I feel like I'm ingrained in it, but I remember those days I didn't really know anyone or anything. How did you guys each get involved in the anti-trafficking world? How did you guys get to be working on this issue?
So I've been working at the Department of Children and Families, our CPS agency, for about 11 years. And my second year in, I went to a training. My coworker was like, come to this training. It's awesome. You learn about human trafficking. And I went and I learned a lot and I became interested in it. And I decided to become a trainer. And then from there, it just took off.
It was a little different for me. I was working at the Village for Families and Children, and the position was brought to my attention. The person thought that I would have some interest in doing human trafficking work. I have a history of sexual assault crisis intervention work. And so this position really felt to me like going back to the beginning of my professional career, doing some advocacy, working with victims directly. And so I, you know, took my shot and I applied for the position. And fortunately I got it. And that was the first time really that I started to learn in depth what human trafficking really is. Before that I had all the stereotypical concepts of what human trafficking was, that it was international, people were being brought here to the United States to be victimized. And once I started as the HART coordinator, my entire world opened up and I realized how much of a domestic issue it was and how much work we had to do in the state of Connecticut, but also nationally. And so it was like an eye-opening experience for me coming into this work.
Awesome.
What about you, Erin?
I've been working in this field in some ways ever since I was in college. I went abroad for my study abroad in Kenya and started working with street children there and started realizing that a lot of the girls found that the safest way for them to be on the streets was either to be with a group of girls with an older male who would traffic them, or that there was a single girl who would be with a group of boys and would be kind of the wife performing sexual favors and stuff. And really what they said was that the police were so corrupt where I was, that was the way for them to stay safest was to do that. And so when I came back to the United States, I started working on child sex tourism, because where I was in Kenya was a heavy tourist area and a lot of the individuals that these young children would have sex with were tourists. And then from there got more connected to trafficking that was happening here in the United States and have continued. So Yvette, many years into kind of our work together, we had done a lot of work together. You brought up this idea of we need to really start addressing race and the issue of race in human trafficking. And Can you just kind of talk a little bit about how that came to your mind? What sparked that for you?
Sure. So the thing is, part of my job as a HEART coordinator was to track data for the state. And I had noticed that, you know, a predominant number of children of color were the ones being referred to the Department of Children and Families at the time, but never really focused heavily on it. Went to Washington, D.C. for one of our grantee meetings, and it was probably maybe 3 or 4 years into the grant. And one of the leads from King County in Washington State did her presentation, because we all had to report out on how we were doing and progress we were making in areas we wanted to continue to work on. And in her report out, she mentioned that in her state, 80%+ of the youth who were being referred to them were Black girls. And that the makeup of King County, and this is a combination of both adults and children, was only 7% Black. So there was an extreme disproportionality being represented in her county, and it just blew me away. I it made me freeze and pause for a minute. And I started to think about our data in Connecticut and was like, you know what? Why are we not having more conversations about this? I've been to these grantee meetings every year. This is the first time anything related to race had come up. And it was just sort of like, here's some information. It wasn't even the lead-in part of the dialogue. And at the end of that conference, we had a meeting, and I just was like, I can't sit still and not say something. So I brought it up as an area that I felt like we needed to focus more on as a movement. It sort of, you know, fell where it needed to fall in people's consciousness, but I didn't really feel like I got the energy I wanted around how important this was. So when I came back to Connecticut, I was like, you know, who could be my allies around this topic? Who can help me sort of message this out further, really start to get some traction about elevating a dialogue around race? And so I thought about you, Erin, because obviously you had worked at Love 146 and, you know, you have experience working directly with clients. And so you would be able to understand. Chris has been in the movement for a while, and he's a person of color, so, and we had a good rapport and relationship. So I knew he would be a good colleague to connect with on that. And that's where sort of the journey for race and human trafficking started. I was really excited when both of you were like, sign us up, we're in, whatever we have to do, let's figure it out and let's, you know, move this work forward. So that was what the catalyst for me was.
And maybe since this is audio and not video, it might be helpful for us all to say what our race is, because people don't know this. So I'm white. I'm Erin, and I'm white.
I'm Yvette. I'm Black.
And I'm Chris. I am from India.
And so we all kind of have brought a different perspective. But I am curious, Yvette, you know, and Chris, I think why do you think there has been such reticence to talk about race in the human trafficking movement?
You know what, Erin, honestly, I'm still asking myself that question, because I don't know. I don't understand why it isn't at the forefront of our dialogue, because the statistics and the data are what they are. And this is not just in the state of Connecticut, it's also nationally. I just think that there's been a narrative for years that predominantly it was white children being victimized. Maybe that's what made people comfortable in, you know, sort of connecting to the movement or the work. I think movies like Taken, that was painting a narrative of, you know, a white, young, affluent individual who was stolen and brought to another state to be victimized. I'm not really sure. And I'm still, as I do trainings and have conversation, I still don't understand fully why it is not at the forefront of our conversation when the numbers are so dramatically huge. So that's my perspective right now. I haven't figured out the answer to that question yet.
I mean, I think we see that issue globally. I mean, you hear about genocide in Africa. You hear about, you know, war crimes in the Middle East, you know, other parts of the world, and it doesn't make national news. But then you have, you know, one shooting or one small bombing in like a European country, and everyone's talking about it. So I think that's just the narrative with our world as a whole.
I think what hurts me the most is that we're part of a movement where people truly are invested in helping, and who I think, you know, mostly are civic minded and socially just in their thinking, but we still are struggling with this particular area. If you ask me what I think the underlying reason for us not having a conversation, and I'm going to automatically go to racism as a factor that I think plays a role in how much people want to have that conversation, how much people want to highlight that children of color are predominantly being victimized. But that's a general sense. What I haven't gotten was very individualized senses of why people aren't really elevating this, who's a part of this movement, who has the data, who understands that this is an issue. So I don't want to speak for anyone because no one has clearly articulated to me the why, but based on what this nation is founded on and the issues of exploitation based on race we have in this country, then that's the only reason, that's the only correlation I can make as to why we're still not having that conversation. What about you, Erin?
So maybe it's because I'm white. I'm going to be a little harder on those of us who are white. Honestly, I think it's because the movement has largely been made up of white professionals. And I think that white people are really uncomfortable talking about race. We don't have the language. I think many white people aren't even aware of our race or have just recently become aware that we have a race because it's been the default. And so the idea of bringing it to the forefront, or the idea of understanding how race plays a role in the victimization, is just something I think that has historically not entered our minds. I think that's why you hear a lot more about gender, because we understand gender, right? We're female, we're male, we get gender. But because we've not thought of ourselves as having a race, we don't really get it. And to the extent that we understand it, it really has to do with racism. And so there's this fear of being labeled as racist. And so therefore the default is not to talk about it, right? Or to be the quote, see colorblind, right? All the things that we were kind of told growing up or through social media or through current media, that you just don't talk about it. So I think it's a disservice. I don't think it's right, but I do think that it has unfortunately led and continues to lead to a lack of an honest conversation of the role race plays in human trafficking.
So can I ask this follow-up question to you, Erin? Because you are the white person on the call with us, right? So you can only share whatever perspective you have that I think Christopher and I probably don't have. Is it because the movement is majority white that the narrative or the focus continues to be on just white individuals who are victimized? Do you think that that's what's causing a lack of push or dialogue? Or do you think it's because, yet again, if you have privilege and this is not an issue that impacts you, or because we have this other piece of if you are white and you are giving back and you're socially just and you're informed, that you're helping to resolve issues for these children of color. And so you're doing good, so you don't have to worry about highlighting the differences that exist between the victims of this crime. Like, where do you think that is coming from? Is it more about the whiteness of the professionals, or is it more about this idea that I'm in a helping profession and I know children of color are being victimized, but I'm helping, so I don't need to focus my energy on the color of their skin?
So I think it's a complicated thing. I think part of why you don't have an answer is because I don't think it's a single narrative or reason. I think some of it is kind of a lack of language of how to talk about it. I think some of it is a fear of looking, self-reflection, right? If you look at the anti-trafficking movement, many people still refer to it as modern day slavery. And there's a lot of issues with that and that we can get into in a little bit. I also think that if you look at the imagery has historically been white girls in some sort of chains with a black man being the trafficker. And if that doesn't resonate with racism, I don't know what does. And so I think there's going to have to be some sort of reckoning within the anti-trafficking movement that we've contributed to stereotypes that have really been hurtful. And then I'm going to be really frank, I think some of it has to do with donors and a fear of how donors are going to respond. I think there's some donors that will really embrace this. And I think there are some donors, and to be honest, we even saw it in Love 146 when we have posted things about race and trafficking and the intersection between race and trafficking. We have gotten some feedback from followers, from donors, that we should stay in our lane, that race does not have to do with it, that how do we know it's not socioeconomic? And so, you know, that is a reality that's out there. Now, at Love 146, I think one of the things I love about it is that we take that as an opportunity to provide education, right? So we try to meet those individuals where they're at and talk to them about how socioeconomic doesn't explain what we're seeing. It doesn't explain the data that there is a disproportionate number of children of color that are being trafficked and that really no child should be trafficked. But I think that it's, you have to make a very conscientious decision as an anti-trafficking organization that you're going to step into this sphere where you're going to have really difficult conversations. And I don't think everybody's comfortable having difficult conversations.
No, I think it's so interesting that you talk about their rationale is almost, it's more socioeconomic, but it's almost like they're, while saying that, dismissing the fact that there's disparities when you look at socio and economic factors among people of color.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting that you said that. I was just going to add that, you know, I heard one person say that people think of prostitution as a victimless crime. And I think people have the same thought about trafficking. And I think people think that even further when it's young girls and boys of color, because there's this idea in our culture, there's these stereotypes. People have this implicit bias that they're just sexualized. And I've seen that happen, I think, in meetings where we've discussed cases where it's like a young Black girl. And it's like, oh, well, no, she's not a victim. She's just ratchet. She's just like that. She likes to twerk and this and that. And so they're viewing things differently because of their race and assumptions they have about the culture and how sexualized that culture is.
Mm-hmm. You see that bias all the time. I remember once doing a training of the trainer, and we were talking about the racial breakdown of the population, and someone who was doing a training, who was doing a teach back, you know, started to refer to Latin girls as hot and promiscuous and sexy. And so that was the perception that was held of those young girls, almost indicating that that's one of the reasons why they were, you know, being victimized at a higher level. So I think there is, and this was a person of color that had done that, not a Latin person, but a person of color. So you see that mindset of how the narrative, which starts historically, right? Because a part of the work that I've been doing through the presentation I'm doing is trying to connect back to this historical context of how people of color were victimized in this nation. So I really do a focus heavily on Native culture and colonization, as well as American slavery, and looking at how those individuals were exploited and the mindset of those who were exploiting them, that they were just objects and that they were property and that they could be used for sex and labor without consequences whatsoever to their white slave owners or to their white colonizers. And then when you flash forward and you think about force, fraud, and coercion that we see in human trafficking, those same tactics were used in American slavery. Those same tactics were used when you were colonizing the Native people, right? And so the mindset and the narrative is there that's been taught from generation to generation. And we now live in a society where these stereotypes and biases are attached to these children, and that history and that legacy has given current day individuals permission to use children of color in this way because it's justifiable. That story I told about the King County story, one of the things that she said in her presentation was that the buyers for these young Black girls were white men because it's a predominantly white community, very affluent community, and that for a lot of those white men, they did not want to buy and purchase sex of white girls because they didn't want to be reminded of their daughters or their relatives, right? So it was easier to exploit a Black child than it was to exploit a child that would look more like them racially, right? And so you see that same mindset when I talk about survivor stories. And when we did that article and let's talk about race and human trafficking, and we highlighted the survivor's perspective, we see how race played a part in the victimization process for that particular survivor. So we have enough, I think this is a part that is frustrating more to me than anything, and really allows me to be grounded in that this is racially rooted, is we have stories. We have survivors of color who share that. We have data from Demand Abolition that says the majority of the perpetrators majority of the buyers are white men with money. We have stats, we have data, we have information, but yet it is not changing the narrative one bit. And we're still grounded in this idea that it's Black men victimizing white children. And so for me, my, I guess, goal or task right now is to try to change that narrative as much as possible so that we can humanize our children of color and our people of color in general, because I think that mindset of you're just an object or a creature to be bought and sold and used still exists in 2021. And that in itself is concerning. And the question is, how is this movement going to start to shift that narrative? And it doesn't take one Black woman on a journey with a few colleagues to get that work done.
Chris, I'm curious. I know you've worked with a lot of the youth that have been trafficked in the state. And I'm wondering how race has shown up for those youth. Kind of how has it played a role in their recruitment, their grooming, their exploitation, even their recovery when they're working with providers? How has race played a role in all of that?
Yeah, so I think when you start out, we think about risk factors. We know that involvement with DCF, involvement with the juvenile justice system, those both are disproportionately children of color. And so automatically you have that leading into it. And then I think we hear stories about how children of color can be sold at a different rate than their white peers and the impact that that has on a child. You know, just imagining specifically even in your teenage years, you talk a lot about self-esteem and self-image and self-worth. And what happens to those things when your literal worth, as defined by a trafficker with a numerical monetary value, varies from somebody who's white. So imagine being a child that's Black and being sold for $75 an hour, but your peer who is white is being sold for $150 an hour. And what message that sends to that victim and that youth. And then also that impacts their self-esteem going forward and that continued desire to be pulled into the life, to try to be better or to be worth more and to be equal to their peer.
Yeah,
I think those all play a role. And then when we see a lot of our youth of color, when they're trying to address this in treatment, I think a lot of our providers don't understand trafficking. I think it differs significantly from just sexual abuse because there's so many additional layers there. And then if providers don't understand the racial dynamics, they can't address them appropriately. And I think that creates an additional barrier.
Yeah, so I agree. I think people are really uncomfortable, even, trained therapists bringing up the role of race in any kind of victimization, but especially trafficking as we're talking about it. I am curious, Chris, from your perspective, is race something that people should proactively provide? You would want to see providers proactively bring up with youth, asking kind of, has race played a role in what you've experienced? And if so, how would you want to let that be brought up by the youth? How would you envision that coming up in a victim-provider relationship?
I think there has to be an opportunity for the youth to bring it up. But also I think sometimes youth may not recognize the role. And part of the role of a therapist or provider is to help them gain insight and understand what's happened and process it. And so maybe they need to bring that up. And I think it's part of that idea of, we talk about people from historically will say, I don't see color. Well, no, it's important to see color. It's important to recognize how color played a role in that person's life and their experiences. And so for a therapist to do that and say, I recognize that you're a person of color. How did that impact your experience? I think that can be really impactful for providers to acknowledge.
Yeah, and I would actually argue it also plays a role for white survivors. So I had a survivor I was working with who was white, and she actually met another survivor who was a person of color, who was male, and had a very strong reaction when she found out that that individual was a survivor, because that individual for her looks like all of the buyers. So she had always had buyers of color. And so the idea that a male of color could also be a victim was really just shook her. And she had to really kind of reformulate how she thought of this type of victimization, how she thought of these type of perpetrators. And I think so I would also argue that race plays a pretty big role for white victims as well, or can play a role that we need to unpack, right? That also might need to be unpacked when you're providing services.
I think looking at the whole person when you're treating someone or when you're capturing a history of their victimization is important. And when I do my presentation on this topic, I always say, please do not make this make you believe that we are negating the victimization of those individuals who are white, because you're right. Race can play a factor in their victimization. They're also victims. Like, let's be clear, they're also victims. The problem is, and this is why race then becomes a complicated conversation, is as soon as we talk about children of color and people of color, and I want to give some statistics so people have context of why this is a dialogue. So nationally, like 77% of victims of human trafficking are people of color. In the state of Connecticut, for about a 5 to plus year window, over 60% annually of victims that were being referred to DCF were children of color. So our context, the reason why this conversation even surfaced, it was because of disproportionality. But what I don't want anyone to walk away from listening to this recording is thinking that we don't value the victimization or think the victimization of white children and white adults is important, because it is. I think what we're trying to say is that this should not happen to anyone. We know that any person can become a victim. We know anyone could be a perpetrator or a buyer. But what we do have to be able to begin to do is have a balanced dialogue around when race factors in, what does that mean, and be prepared to really address the issues that come up for children of color, because they're also dealing with other forms of oppression and other levels of victimization when they live in a system that is set up to make them fail already. And that, you know, there's so much disproportionality across all systems of supports for these communities that they're now dealing with another compounded issue. So it's really trying to make sure that we're looking at the whole child, the whole adult, when we're doing treatment and work.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a really good point. I'm curious, still going, looking at the individual child, how important do you think it is for children of color to have representation in their service providers, to see themselves and see other individuals of color amongst their service provider team?
I think it's extremely important. I think just that, you know, having somebody who understands your life experiences, at least from a racial perspective, can really make a difference for some youth. You know, I've had youth that would come to the Department of Children and Families that were children of color, and would say, you know, I'm tired of sitting in a room full of people that don't look like me. And I would get assigned their case somehow. You know, they'd be like, oh, well, Chris is a person of color, let's give it to him. And it's interesting how my rapport and my relationship with them was so much different than that of other workers that were white. I mean, it just my race, I think, played a role in my ability to have that child open up. Because they saw someone who was like, okay, well, you kind of look like me. Maybe you understand me in a different way. But yeah, I think the representation is important.
I mean, you're also a pretty fun guy and a pretty cool guy. Oh, well, so, you know, Chris, your personality could be a little bit
more. Yeah, part of your that personality too. Is probably the reason why.
Yeah. Both of it. How about you, Yvette?
I agree 100% with what Chris is saying. I think representation is important. I think there's connections that people make based on their lived experiences that sometimes does not work cross culture or cross race. And so the movement does need to be more diverse. The reality is that from top executive positions all the way down to line staff that's working in this field, there needs to be more representation so more of these issues are being discussed and are surfacing, and that there are folks who are passionate about making sure that, you know, we're keeping a lens on this particular issue and that the victims of this crime are receiving the support that they need and not being dismissed or disregarded because of a lack of context by the person who's providing them with care, or those people making decisions legislatively or otherwise don't understand why it's important to support this particular movement because of the impact it has on the lives of those who are victimized because they may disregard it because race is a factor. So I can't emphasize enough from every single layer in this movement, more work has to be done around this particular issue.
So you brought up the legislator, and obviously if we're talking about large scale systems changed, lawmakers are a critical component. Policy is integral in this. So what do you think the impact is of the fact that most legislative bodies are predominantly white? And what impact do you think that has on laws, both specifically related to human trafficking, but also other legislation that might be peripherally related, housing legislation, education legislation, things that certainly impact the youth we work with, but might not have the term human trafficking in them?
I think it's a factor for sure that predominantly our legislators are white and making decisions that impact everyone's lives. But what I find fascinating from doing this work for 5 or 6 years, when issues of human trafficking are brought in front of the legislation, the focus isn't on the race of the victims. It's always on what is that piece of legislation that needs to be passed. And the majority of the faces who go into lobby for changes related to human trafficking are white. So it's really hard to say, would things be different if, you know, race was discussed during those conversations? Would the outcomes be different if it was majority people of color presenting the issue in front of a legislative body? I can't gauge how that would change. But one of the things I'm very clear about doing this work for so long, we don't bring race up when we have those conversations at the legislative level. In testimonies, that is not the key issue that's highlighted. And so the representation makes it appears that there's an issue that is predominantly for white individuals because we don't ID or identify what victims look like with this crime other than it's sex or labor. So that's a hard one to answer.
And I know we're talking about race predominantly today, but I think we have to look at gender too. And so as the male in the room, I'll be the one to bring that up. We know, as Yvette mentioned, a vast majority of buyers are white men who are making six figures or more. And when we look at legislators, what do we see? We see predominantly white men. And we know that there have been stings across the country where legislators have been found to be involved in buying or in trafficking. So I think that plays a role as well.
Yeah, for sure.
So Erin, as someone who does a lot of legislative work, and you know, we've been partners for several years, going to the legislative office building to advocate. We have one coming up soon, this legislative session. How do you think race factor into the decisions that are made at that level?
You know, it's interesting because every time we've done a presentation, we did a presentation last year at the LOB about race and trafficking. We've done presentations throughout the community. Every time we've done it, we have packed rooms. I don't think we've ever spoken to a room where the subject has been, the headline has been, we're going to talk about race and human trafficking, where that room has not been packed, which indicates to me that people want to hear about this. They want to learn about this. So how come it's not translating from kind of the larger symposiums or the larger conferences to the day-to-day discourse? I'm not sure, but I agree that it hasn't filtered in a lot to the day-to-day discourse. Now I do see movement. I do think things are getting better. I'm seeing a lot more people bringing it up. As it relates to the legislature, I think it's really hard. I think certainly, I think I need to do a better job of raising it. I think there's other people that, you know, that testify. I think when I look back at who kind of are the key people that always show up to testify when there's a trafficking related bill, they do tend to be white. And so I think, you know, it's on us. We need to bring it up. It is hard, Chris, because I think that you are correct that a lot of legislators do, if they're going to empathize with one of the key players in this situation, it might be the buyer. And so that is who they're going to think of first. So when we talk about, you know, holding buyers accountable or what we need to do to eradicate this, their point of reference is going to possibly be, well, if it's not me, I might have a friend who does that. I might have a cousin or a brother. And that might be their point of reference, as opposed to, I have a sister who you know, was caught up in that. I have a young niece who was caught up in that, or a young nephew. And so I think that those conversations need to happen. I'm not sure if they need to happen publicly in it yet. I think that that could backfire on those of us who are trying to pass legislation. I'm not someone who likes to shame legislators, unless they obviously need to and are involved in it. But I do think that you can have those conversations one-on-one when you're providing education in between sessions and when you're having those discussions. Yeah, I think that it's an important thing to bring up.
I want to comment on something you said earlier about the packed room. And I found that, I think specifically with the issue of human trafficking, people are find it very interesting. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. You know, when I tell people about me doing anti-trafficking work, they're like, that's so cool. And I'm like, okay, that's an interesting word. And you know, just their perspective of it is it's really cool subject, and it's really popular right now. And so it must be great work to do. And so I think people are interested in the topic as a topic, and they become overwhelmed with emotion when they hear about it, but then they don't want to follow up. They don't want to take action. They just want to kind of hear the stories and learn about it and kind of be able to say they went to a trafficking training. But a lot of people don't want to get involved in the work.
Yeah. Sometimes that's okay. Some of those people we might not want involved in the direct service. Those people can donate.
Very true.
You know, there's a role for everybody in the mm-hmm. movement. We need donors. We need people that do volunteer backpack drives for us. But I think that it is very, very emotional issue. And I also think that you have a visceral response sometimes among individuals who are want to hold somebody accountable. And I think in my opinion, one of the ways that I would like to see the anti-trafficking movement shift in general is moving a little bit away from a juvenile or a criminal justice approach and more towards a public health approach, both in terms of focus, but also in terms of legislation and monetary investment. I think yes, do I want to hold traffickers accountable? Of course. I mean, I think, do I care if buyers are held accountable? Probably to a lesser extent. I want to hold the traffickers accountable. But do I care if victims are taken care of and have services and supports and reduce the risk for re-victimization? That's my number one priority. If I could take any three of those, and I could only have one, I would absolutely invest all my money in supporting victims and investing in prevention education and preventative efforts so this doesn't happen. So when you look at where we're spending our time and our energy and our resources, we are so disproportionately spending those energies and resources on the first two, on are we holding traffickers accountable? Are we holding buyers accountable? You know, there's this whole debate, should we legalize or not legalize prostitution? What impact will that have on human trafficking? And in my mind, we are wasting copious amounts of time, energy, and resources that would be better invested in talking about how do we support victims? How do we prevent vulnerabilities? How do we provide enough preventative support so that this doesn't happen in the first place? And when it does, those individuals are taken care of.
But you know what I find fascinating with what you just said, Erin, is that if most of our resource and energy is going to the trafficker and buyer, we're doing a really crappy mm-hmm. job. Because yep. the reality is that they're not being arrested. They're not being held accountable. Victims are being arrested and sent to jail. So it kills me, right, that there's so much energy and money and resources invested in that legal side of it, and it's not manifested in anyone really serving the consequences for their actions and behaviors. And it still brings up the question of the why. Why is it that we don't have more prosecution for buyers? Why is it that we don't have more prosecution for traffickers, but we have such high level of victimization, right? And then when you throw in race as a factor, even though nobody wants to talk about it, is race a factor in why we're seeing less prosecution? Because children of color or people of color don't have as much value and worth to end up, you know, criminalizing white men who are predominantly the buyers, or even a diverse group of traffickers that include, you know, diverse racial groups. It's not just men of color who are victimizing. And if you take a look, you know, who gets, for the traffickers that we know, because we know it's white, Black, Asian, Latin, all of them, who are the ones who are getting prosecuted? Is it a diverse group of people who are being prosecuted for the trafficking side, or is it predominantly people of color who are going to jail for this crime, even though they're not the only ones that are prosecuting? So for me, part of my hope is, you know, as we move forward in this work, is how do we really have a conversation about human trafficking as a racial justice issue? When you talk about this becoming a public health issue, how do we talk about the dynamics that's leading to this lack of support? So you're talking about services and victims. Is it not focused in that area because the numbers are speaking to predominantly children of color or people of color? So that's why that's not happening. And so all the energy is going over here to say, let's worry about traffickers and buyers, but we're not going to really do anything, because when we look at the data and analysis here, it's predominantly white men who are buying. And with the traffickers, maybe we'll prosecute the people of color, but let the other folks go because of their race. There's so many, when we talk about the justice system and all the other systems of oppression that we have in this country, are we surprised or shocked after 5 or 6 years of doing this work that we're still struggling when race is such a factor in this particular victimization?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the part of that question is, so much of this is caught up in very large systems, right? There, it's caught up in the, you know, the education system, the criminal justice system, it's caught up in the child welfare system, all of which we have copious amounts of data show are disproportionate, treat children of color differently. And children of color are disproportionately involved in the criminal justice system. They're disproportionately involved in the child welfare system. I guess, you know, one of the things that I am curious about is, at that systems level, what would you like to see change? You've both been involved in the child welfare system. You've both had youth who have been involved in the juvenile justice system. What do you think, and education system, what do you think are some of the changes we need to see?
I'm going to say I'm just going to give one response, and then Chris, I'll let you tag in because I don't want to be vocal the whole time. But I think diversity and representation is one of the things I would like to see. When I was a HAARP coordinator, I was one of a few handful of people of color that sat at tables that were making decisions about the movement and the work that needed to be done. If we're going to change narratives, if we're going to push the system, then we need representation of people who come from the communities that are being victimized and marginalized and disproportionately negatively impacted by the system that we live in. Doesn't mean it's going to automatically switch over, but more representation might help shift that narrative and that dialogue. When I went to grantee meetings, I was one of a handful of people of color across 9 different grants that were sitting in the room to be able to elevate and have conversations where race could have even been brought up as a discussion or even highlighted as a major issue, or who would have been able to push the issue of race forward. So representation, as I said, at all levels in this work is critically important.
So I would definitely agree with Yvette in that the, you know, having a diverse group of people at the table is important. But I think even making it a priority within the agencies that are responsible for addressing trafficking need to have people that are designated to be addressing trafficking. A lot of the people at these agencies that are doing trafficking work are doing trafficking almost like as a extracurricular, I call it, activity. It's on top of their regular job. There aren't people that are designated specific to be working on human trafficking. And that's across multiple departments and agencies that are supposed to be responsible for addressing this issue. But nobody's really taking, you know, the lead.
Yeah, I think that is probably true in a lot of states. I know we're in Connecticut, but I don't think that we're alone in experiencing that. As a white person, what would you want to see from other white people? What would you hope that my colleagues, who again, as we've discussed, are overrepresented among in the anti-trafficking movement in terms of the professionals, what do you want from us? What can we do?
I can answer that. I want people to move away, because I want people to stop saying I'm woke but not doing the work, right? I want people to stop saying I understand, I get it. But when you're at tables, you're not pushing a dialogue or you're not changing the narrative because you sit in positions of power, right? So we know that predominantly white individuals are in positions of power in this movement, have access nationally to each other to have conversations about this, and even in the state level to make some decisions related to this. I don't want to hear that you get it. I don't want to hear that you have the data and you know and you're doing your best. I want people to stop saying they're conscious and aware, but actually make the moves and push the system to change. So if you have the ability to change a policy or practice, change it. If you have the ability to sit at a table and force the rest of the people at that table to have a conversation related to this issue and really make, even though it's going to be uncomfortable, talk about how do we make a difference and what are we going to tangibly do? Not just come to a presentation and walk away saying, wow, that's horrible and I wish we could do something, but then go back and you have a sphere of influence and you don't use it. I want people to do more. Like, as a person of color, I'm doing the presentations. I came back to Connecticut and spoke to both of you because I didn't want to just know there was a problem and just sat on it, but that I was actually going to do something and invest my time and energy, talents, and gifts to actually try to move change. So for me, the awareness work I'm doing through my training is to start to get people to understand this issue didn't just start today, that this issue has a history, and that we live in a nation whose in its DNA is racism. Like, this nation is built on human trafficking, right? It's built on exploitation. And unless people want to be cognizant of that and challenge the privilege that they hold, or question the people in their immediate family that is allowing for this crime to perpetuate, we're not going to get anywhere. So I'm passionate in saying I don't want to hear people talk about what they want to do in their best interests anymore. If you have a position of influence and power, use it to change the narrative immediately, not wait until someone of color forces you to do it.
How about you, Chris?
Wow. That's hard to follow that. I would love to see my white peers be more like you, Erin. I think you use your voice. I think you advocate every opportunity you can get. And that's rare. So I would just echo everything Yvette said and commend you for always being at the front with this work and speaking out.
And I'll just say, just to echo what Chris is saying, because once Erin got a part of this movement, we started talking and we started, you know, doing the article, doing the radio shows. One of the conversations Erin and I had a couple of times was what work she was doing nationally when she was sitting at tables, at trafficking tables, how she was starting to elevate the conversation about race. And so you are a prototype. You are an example of what we need white leadership to look like in this movement, is to challenge, you know, the regular standard of way of doing things and thinking and bucking a system. I know that in your organization, you guys have been doing a lot of work around racial justice and educating your staff so that they're informed and aware of what they need to do and how they need to be mindful about issues of race when they're working with clients. That's the work that I'm talking about, is actually doing something, not just saying you feel empathy for or you regret that this is happening, but you have actually taken tangible steps to try to change the system that you work within. And that is what we need for folks to do.
Thank you. I mean, honestly, I learned from both of you guys. You know, it's definitely needs to be a collaborative effort, because I would not be able to do this if I hadn't talked to, you know, if Yvette, if you hadn't come back from that conference and really pushed this issue, if we hadn't delved into it, you know, I can't guarantee that I would be talking about it the way that I do, to be honest. So I think that it does take all of us, because we need people of color to say, hello, you guys are missing something critical. And then we also need white people who are currently in a lot of those positions to take it up and to bring it to the forefront. And I would add that, you know, as white people are in positions of in which they can hire individuals, other individuals in positions of power, that they should look at representation, and that is a key variable and really important thing to look at. And I think a lot of people are scared to talk about that. But I think you guys have both pointed to the importance of representation. And in some organizations, that's going to mean white people actively looking at representation and considering it as part of their hiring process and recognizing that they're not representative. So I guess in my final question, if in 5 years, and that's a short time period, I don't think we're going to solve all of the racial justice issues in the, that time period by any means, but if in 5 years you were to reflect and you were able to say, you know what, we have made progress as a movement, I can see progress has been made, what would that look like 5 years down the line? What would you like to see?
I've always been a big advocate for awareness and prevention. I think once our kids are brought into the life of trafficking, it is very hard for them to admit to it or acknowledge it and to identify them. So I've always said that prevention is key. And so making training mandatory among, you know, teachers and school and providers, you know, making it just really a priority to make sure that everyone is educated on this topic is going to be huge. And so I think we've made a lot of progress. I think we're getting our awareness trainings that we have out there and training tons of people, but I think we need to continue and make sure that everyone is trained and everyone's aware, knows the red flags, knows what to look for. I think that's most important for me personally.
And would you like to see race tied into some of that training as we go around?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
I think for me, more representation across the entire system and all levels of influence is going to be something I would hope to see in 5 years from now. I think more survivors of color's perspective elevating and, you know, really being able to have that shared to influence and drive the movement in the direction we need it to go. I think for me, in 5 years, I would hope that we have legislation that fully protects our victims and not our buyers and traffickers. And that in 5 years from now, we should see more accountability on the buyer and trafficker side so we can reduce the number of individuals who are being victimized. If we continue to focus just on the victim and survivors and we do nothing about the demand side of this work, or we do nothing about holding the traffickers accountable, then this is a crime that they'll continue to commit because the impact for their lives is minimal. And so we have to value our victims more and show them that we value them by holding those who have victimized them accountable for their actions. So I'm hoping legislatively we have strong laws in place that will allow for that to happen more. And for me, in 5 years, I hope to continue to be doing awareness work related to trafficking and also around race and human trafficking, and hoping that I've reached a large enough population around this topic for there to be a little bit more understanding of why this is an important topic to be discussing.
Yeah. And Yvette, your comments, again, and this is one of the things I think is important for white people to realize, is it made me realize that, you know, 5 or 10 minutes ago, I was talking about how I didn't care as much if we held buyers accountable. I didn't care as much about holding the traffickers. I cared more about providing victim services and prevention education. But in some ways, what I'm also saying is not hold white people accountable for what they're doing against children of color. So I think that it's important, again, for, you know, us white people, we're going to keep making mistakes. We're going to keep saying things and not realizing the implicit nature of what we are implying in our speech. But I realized when you were speaking that is what I said, that is the implicit message I was sending, is let's not focus so much on holding white people accountable who are purchasing our children for sex, and let's focus on providing services. But you're absolutely right, Yvette. We do need to also hold people who are white, and not just white, but predominantly white, accountable for committing crimes against children. So I really, again, I appreciate both of you. I'm always learning from both of you. I appreciate the grace with which you allow me to make mistakes as I learn and continue to educate me as we walk through this together. And hopefully our collective work and other people's work in this field can really elevate this issue.
I just want to, in closing, say that I'm really happy that we had the opportunity to do this. I'm glad, Erin, you had brought this up, and that we were able to come together as a trio again to really elevate this conversation. And I think what I would want to say to those who are listening is just have the conversations. Like, we just spent about 40 minutes or so talking about this, and we all realize in the conversation and dialogue things that we need to do and work on, or what else we need to do to make the system better. And the only way that happens is to just having a conversation. So I just want to encourage everyone to go back to your families, go back to your organizations, and bring the topic up, have a conversation. Know it's going to be awkward and uncomfortable, but at the end of this, you might come up with some solutions, or you might have some insight that helps you figure out how to do the work better.
I also am so thankful that we were able to have this opportunity to have this conversation. And I'm hoping that in the future, folks will listen back to this and think about, you know, how horrible this thing that happened back in the day, and that it's not happening now, but maybe it's eradicated at that point.
Great. Well, thank you both.
Thanks, you guys. Glad that we got to connect again.
Thank you.